So I wanted to get your thoughts on how you think the management and technology consulting area is being commoditized. Can you talk, or disrupted at least?
Well, there is a real pattern in that the vertical axis in a professional services firm, whether this is investment banking or consulting,
sure,
actually is the size of the project,
okay,
or the size of the client.
Like, all right.
Big projects are much more lucrative to the partner
than small projects.
Are.
Definitely.
And so I'm going to just use this. My language is going to be in constant $2007, roughly.
Okay.
And very approximate. But who knows how Booz Allen and ADL started, but they were the first. And then McKinsey comes along in the late 30s. And they actually were a product company, not a consulting firm. And that is, they had this concept called the M4 and business units that emerged out of work that had been done in DuPont. And basically they said, for about $250,000, let us come into your company and we will divide you into business units. And they just went And that's why I say it was a product, not a service. It was a very standardized offer.
Totally understand that, yep.
And then at some point, one of their clients said, you know, don't go ka-chunk another company, but stay here. You seem like smart young people. Solve this other problem for me. And for the first time, they experienced the sweet smell of larger projects with the same client.
Mm.
And little by little, as they evolved in that trajectory, realizing more and more that if you do non-standard problem-solving stuff, the billings per project per client escalate.
Steadily increase.
And we make so much money. You know? And in particular, as solving those unstructured problems is very data driven, we can put armies of people on the ground, and we at the top of the pyramid can make boatloads of money.
Right.
And so a typical McKinsey client engagement now will be $10 million, not $250,000. And $250,000 projects just make no sense. Well, then BCG comes along in '63, and basically for $250,000 per engagement, you know, come here and pay us this money, we'll do an experience curve for your industry. Pay us this money, we'll take your conglomerate and we'll do the cash cow stars dog matrix.
Right.
And they just went ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk.
Uh-huh.
And if you worked at BCG in the 60s and early 70s, that's what life was like for you, just like the M form was what life was about prior to World War II at McKinsey.
Got it.
Then the very same thing happened to BCG. Stay here. Take on this other strategy problem. And so they just completed, I just learned this from students and so on, $150 million project to help Pfizer digest Pharmacia.
Wow.
Who should we fire? Who shouldn't we fire? This is a long way from strategy. In fact, I had a major client or a friend at BCG come to me to say, you know, last year we, a shockingly low percentage of our billings were on strategy projects. And he said, how can we get back into strategy? And I said, you can't. And the reason is that a strategy project is inherently a $500,000 project.
Project, yes. It's capped.
It has a beginning, it has an end. And when the alternative for your sales force, which is your partners, is to have these huge operational effectiveness, data-intensive projects that armies of people have to go on site to do, you just don't sell strategy. And there's evidence of what's happened there. When they train their non-MBA hires every summer,
right,
these are PhDs and law students and doctors and so on, they outsource the training on strategy to Clay Christensen.
No, no.
Because none of their partners can competently train on strategy.
Interesting.
It's a competence that now doesn't fit the business model.
Right.
So then Bain
split. Is it the classic they're overshooting it at that point? That's what you were talking about.
Yeah, their economic model has overshot what strategy is. And so the vertical axis, it has nothing to do with quality per se, but it's the size of the project, because
sure,
that's how they make money. So then Bain comes off, They have this standard way of creating strategy for a business unit, which is cost, customers, competition. Mm-hmm. And for a price point of $250,000, bring your business unit here and we'll give you a strategy.
Sure.
They just went ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. And then they experience the sweet smell of non-standard.
Right. And they go up market.
Yeah.
Is basically
bigger and bigger and bigger projects.
Sure.
Leave strategy behind. And then Monitor comes in. And at a price point of about $250,000.
Yep.
Bring your company here and we'll do the five forces for you. Mm-hmm. And then they move up to big non-standard stuff. So then interestingly, Michael Hammer comes in.
Oh yeah.
Publishes this book called Reengineering the Corporation.
Sure.
And created his own consulting firm. Within 2 years, every one of the mainstream consulting firms had launched a process reengineering project.
Practice, yes.
So, yeah, practice. So why is it that they all copied instantly Michael Hammer's idea, but McKinsey didn't get strategy for 20 years, and BCG didn't get cost, customers, and competition ever, and none of them ever got five forces?
Hmm.
Is it because Hammer's book was clearer than Bruce Henderson's writings or Michael Porter's writing? No.
No.
But what it was is that reengineering entailed putting jillions of consultants on the ground, synthesizing reams of data, billing tens of millions of dollars. And so the idea was a sustaining innovation relative to the business models of the existing firms, and they killed Hammer's firm.
Mm-hmm. Right, because they adopted it. Right.
The entrant tried to enter with an innovation that was on the sustaining path of those.
So the order of magnitude leapfrog.
That's right.
Right. Gotcha.
But these guys, the, you know, these others, their entry strategy was disruptive relative to the business models of where the prior leaders were going.
Mm-hmm.
So that's happening. And now I think that the world is just ripe again for a disruption. In my, I mean, this still sounds self-serving, but our little firm, InnoSight, is, we call it theory-driven consulting. That is, if it's a way to think of it. Prior to World War II, if you were in the business of looking for oil, 90% of the holes you drilled were dry.
Mm-hmm.
So you just had to drill and drill and drill and drill. And you spent most of your life drilling dry wells. And the more wells you drilled, the more oil you found, but it was very unproductive. But then geophysicists started to bring to the enterprise after World War II theories. And having a theory allowed you then to be very parsimonious about, you knew exactly what data you needed to collect from a structure to be able to predict whether there was oil down there.
Sure.
And so the possession of a theory allows you to be very economical in getting just the data you need and interpreting it in just the right way. And so at much lower cost, total cost now, they can drill these holes, and 60% of the holes strike oil. So it's not a cookbook yet.
Right.
The theory has enabled them to be much more efficient. And so our whole business model is, if you've got theories of strategy and innovation, it tells you exactly what data to look for, you know?
Okay.
And so you can deliver a higher quality result to a client at much lower cost if you guide your search for the insights by through theories rather than just analyze the gazoo out of data.
Right, you know? Right.
But I see venture capital being disrupted by a really different business model, and I think strategy consulting gets disrupted in the same way.
How about the Indian firms? You touched on it briefly in your presentation today.
Yeah.
Clearly, they're moving up market, right? They disrupted the IT departments, and it's very similar to your Flextronics compact example,
that's
right?
Exactly.
How? And now they're moving up market into strategy and moving onshore onto strategy. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, if I were running one of the big consulting firms, I would be scared witless.
Yeah.
You see IBM.
Yep.
Really
services.
Doing IT services consulting But that becomes commoditized, you know, as the interfaces become clearer and clearer amongst the pieces of the IT system. Mm-hmm. So it's more standardized in its architecture. They move up into non-standard, just business consulting.
Correct.
Right? And the Indians are right underneath them.
Yep, with the technology, straight
pushing
up technology.
Them up, you know.
Right.
So it's McKinsey and BCG have, they've had a reputational barrier. You know, and so Accenture and Deloitte have had a tough time recruiting. See, when the ability to deliver the result for the client is really resonant in the intuition and intelligence of individual consultants,
that's right,
then recruiting the best from the best business schools is absolutely critical to success. And Deloitte and Accenture have a hard time doing that. So they'd say, but I think that especially the Indians, you know, these are very smart people.
Yeah, sure.
And at much lower cost.
Much lower cost, yeah.
And I really think they have an interesting potential to do.
Yep, definitely. So on a different tangent, can you talk a little bit about how to build a purposeful brand? And can that be done to an existing brand? And do you need to start at the business model level? I mean, that's one of the quandaries I've had in listening to your purposeful brand.
You can do it inside of a business model. That's not a problem.
Okay.
But let's just come back to General Motors.
Okay.
So here, and I'll talk
pick
about
on General Motors.
Yeah. So they. Everybody does it the same way. They structure the market by product category.
Yep.
So GM has this mid-size car called a Malibu. And it competes against other mid-size cars, which include the Camry and the Accord, the two most reliable cars in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very hard game to win if you're going to fight the game the way that game is played traditionally in that industry. Just no way.
No way to win.
Right. But you can redefine the game by there are jobs to be done. So one job is, as I mentioned, my car is my office
the
job.
The car is an office.
But you would have to cut the world completely differently. So you would have a subcompact, a compact, a midsize, a full size, an SUV, a minivan,
office,
small
car.
Truck. Each of which is an office car.
Got it.
Right? And it would not, you then could not have Cavalier, Malibu, you know, Astra, whatever these things are. You just got to leave those aside and let those brands waste away.
Mm-hmm.
But you need another brand that comes to people's mind. I got to work in my car, and this brand pops to your head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the dealership would work very differently, wouldn't it? Because it, you know, it's not a Chevy dealership.
No, it's the mobile office dealership.
Yeah, that's right. And so the one in one way, it is very exciting as a way to put the competition off balance. It's for some reason, but as I was saying right at the very end, you can't hot swap one thing into the old system.
Correct.
It causes a completely new system. And GM set up Saturn as a disruptive business.
Right.
They then kind of lost their steam as they pulled it back into the mainstream. But they'd have to set up a Saturn.
Right.
That looked really different. You know.
And creates its own value network.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And for reasons I don't understand, so if you could figure this out, it'd be marvelous. But when a company develops a system that gets a job done, it seems like it's harder for the established competitors to react to that than it is for them to react to a disruption. It's a good example.
Got it. Okay.
There's this job that was sitting out there needing to be done for centuries. I got to get this from here to there with perfect certainty as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And before FedEx, what did you hire? UPS took 5 days.
Yep.
Airmail took anywhere from 3 days to 10 years. You know?
Right.
Or you'd hire somebody to sit on a plane and take it there. Then FedEx comes in. And looked at through the lens of disruption, this is a sustaining innovation relative to UPS. Very high margins, same customers as you, and yet it took UPS 15 years to get into the overnight delivery business. And I think it probably is that the established competitor, when you think of the market as being structured by product category, first class mail, second class mail, parcel, post, and all that stuff, you don't have an institution in the company that is capable of responding in an end-to-end way to a job.
As opposed to a disruptive technology.
That's right. It's,
I got you.
It's kind of a disruption, but of a different sort.
It disarms the competition in a way that they're not capable of reacting.
Yeah, disarming technology might be a great, but you got it.
Yeah.
Got it, you know. So GM would have to do that, have to create a system. And they could do it. It's inside the GM umbrella, but not within any of those old business units. And it absolutely would need a new brand. So there's another job out there, and I don't mean to sound sexist here, but this arises in the lives of men age 45 to 70, where they just want to express their love to their wives in a way that causes the wife to feel, oh my gosh, my husband really loves me. And I can tell that he just wants to take care of me. Right? And there are lots of things that a husband can hire to do
get that job done.
One of which is a car. You know, husbands buy cars for spouses all of the time.
Okay.
You know, but no car is designed to be an expression of love.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
And no car is designed so that every time the wife starts it up, she thinks, does love me, doesn't he? You know?
Yeah.
But a system, not just a car, but OnStar, and a system of value-added services and reminders and other kinds of things that surround the physical product would actually be a marvelous innovation in the automobile industry.
Sure.
It's just not a mid-sized car, you know?
Exactly.
And so that competes against the sense of diamonds.
Right.
You know.
Which is where, oh, by the way, which is where I thought you might have been going at the onset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, immediately you can tell where my branding has come from, because I thought you were going to talk about De Beers.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
There you are.
Yeah.
You know? And Hallmark has this tagline, when you care enough to send
the very best.
But there's a great opportunity in the automobile industry for a purpose brand that kind of the screwy thing about when that tagline, when you care enough to send the very best, is out there, and you have this job you need to do for your wife, you don't dare buy anything else but the brand that's associated with the very best.
Definitely.
So again, there's a really great opportunity for somebody to differentiate a car.
Conversation for another time.
Yeah.
So another question for you. There's a lot of disruptive technologies out there, new disruptive technologies out there in the Web 2.0 space. I just wanted to get your viewpoint on what you think is happening in that space around blogging, podcasting, video casting, you know, RSS. Clearly Google is somewhat tangentially associated with that through the acquisition of YouTube.
Yeah.
What do you see as some of the most exciting things that from your vantage point?
Well, I still think, you know, I say excited because as an outsider, it is very interesting. If I was on the inside, it's kind of not very exciting.
Okay.
But the disruption of the journalism industry overall is just really working. Newspapers get hit first.
Mm-hmm.
So on the advertising side of the newspaper, Google, first direct mail that disrupted them.
Right.
But then Google makes advertising so much more affordable for people who couldn't afford to put an ad in the Washington Post. You know?
Definitely.
And then Craigslist and Realtor.com and Autotrader.com, they're just pulling that out in a very scary way.
Right.
And then on the editorial side, the Metro that gets passed out at the subway entrance is disruptive, CNN.com.
Right.
So almost everything. Now, for the bloggers, it's kind of interesting. I skipped over the slide, but in Chapter 6 of the Innovator's Solution is this thing that's named in honor of Mr. Rodney Steed, who was my high school physics teacher.
Okay.
It's called the Law of Conservation of Attractive Profits. And what it says is that at one stage of the value-added chain, as things become commoditized, and they get commoditized when you overshoot and the architecture is standardized, it initiates a reciprocal process of decommoditization at the adjacent stages in the value chain.
Okay.
So, in autos, the architecture of the car, as it becomes modular, the auto actually becomes a commodity. But what becomes decommoditized are the subsystems from the tier one suppliers, as inside of themselves they become more proprietary. And then on top of it, General Motors' OnStar system is an example that makes the use of the commodity more productive.
Right.
And we have a case about OnStar in my course, and these are estimates that I just derived from public statements of. But it looks like this year OnStar will generate about $3.5 billion in revenue for General Motors. Operating profit, about $700 million. And it has negative net assets. So in an industry where profitability is measured by ROA, OnStar adds to the numerator and subtracts from the denominator.
That's fabulous.
See, it's becoming decommoditized even while the car becomes commoditized, you know? And so the industry doesn't get commoditized. It's just what it is Michael Porter's Five Forces model is a static model. At a given point in time, this is where attractive money is made. But the forces shift in a very predictable way as disruption happens. Okay, mm-hmm. So you can. The first thing we wrote about this was like 8 years ago. It said it's the subsystem, the tier ones, where the money will be made in the future. And now it's really starting to turn that way. You know, Denso and
right.
JCI and so on. Well, anyway, so the advent of the blogosphere commoditizes the global network of New York Times reporters, because accessing the news was not good enough. And so integrating into that stage of value added was critical to the success of that enterprise. But now anybody who can type can gather news and report it.
That's right. You know.
And so the problem is at the next stage of value added, I am in a wash. Information.
Yeah.
Who in the world knows what I should believe?
Yeah.
And so a new model needs to emerge there that somehow synthesizes, validates, brands, makes accessible and simple this, you know. But it's not the gathering of news that matters. It's the branding of news, the sifting and the straining and the synthesizing. And then being that inside of all of these, the distribution of news is commoditized, but it's that layer between gathering and distribution that needs to get decommoditized.
Mm.
You know, so there's a big growth opportunity for somebody in there.
Definitely.
And the neat thing about YouTube and those guys is it commoditizes the creation of content.
That's right. And user-generated content at that.
That's right. So anybody can generate it.
Right.
Anybody can, you know. And I'd love to see those content providers get commoditized. to visualize where the value gets created, these guys from Bose up in the Boston area came to see me. And I'm sorry, I talked so long. But they developed this device in their automotive systems business that I'm going to kind of bastardize the concept. So they've got this huge disk drive in the trunk of the car, and it downloads music from radio stations that you select from XM radio.
Yes.
Massive drives, you know. And then when you start the car up, it plays music at you. And you know when you were a little kid and you blindfold your sister and spin around and play hotter, hotter, colder, colder.
Right.
Yes. So it has the same logic. So it plays a piece of music at you, and if you like it, you press hotter. And if you don't like it, you press colder. And then it'll play another piece of music at you. And if it helps you feel the way you want to feel even more, you press warmer or colder. And they'll play another one at you, and so on. So in about 2 minutes, it will have identified a feel to music that causes you to feel like you want to feel, which is the job you want done.
You're hiring.
And then it develops a mathematical algorithm that characterizes that tone or feel of music. And then it just reaches back into the disk drive and pulls out all the songs that feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just call that, you know, playlist number one. But it's not a playlist by artist or by genre.
Sure.
But it corresponds to the job you needed to get done. And then when you're going home, you may want to feel a different way. And so it will, you know. So the neat thing about that is it actually does not matter whether the music is being provided by name a rock star.
Sure, any particular artist, right.
Has very low morals and you don't want your children to know about them. You know. Or it might just be a high school senior who can sing like Jennifer Lopez.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And she may just have two songs, not enough to cut a CD and not a big enough name to have gotten distribution through Tower Records. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, and so the artist gets commoditized, and where the money is made is by the company that solves the new problem that isn't being solved well enough. That is, I'm awash in content. So please, somebody help me find the content I need to get the job done.
Right. Excellent.
Again, it's the law of conservation of attractive profits.
Superb. Superb.
Well,
thank you for your time.
Great question.
Appreciate it.
It takes a lot more talent to ask a good question than it does to get an answer.
I had a lot to choose from, so thanks again.
Okay, well, good luck.